Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, as U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta begins his Asia-Pacific tour, we'll ask how much of it will be overshadowed by rising tensions between China and Japan.
It is in everybody's interest for Japan and China to maintain good relations and to find a way to avoid further escalation.
Also in the next hour, as Sweden prepares to announce a stimulus package, could the original welfare state be under threat? We'll be talking to the business editor of Svenska Dagbladet. And with the London Design Festival in full swing, we'll be joined by its deputy director, Max Fraser, live in studio, who'll be talking to us through tomorrow's Global Design Forum. Plus, we'll turn the pages of our new issue, which hits newsstands this week. Today, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, will be talking us through the month's theme.
Yes, it's a Lusophone theme, so I will be explaining all about a diplomatic organisation many people might not have heard of, and telling you all about the musical tastes of Brazil's foreign minister.
Now, is that just in part because that was your trip as well, Steve?
Maybe.
Okay. Also, we will hear about an Indian author, Jeet Thayil, whose latest novel, Necropolis, recently made the Booker Prize shortlist.
What does it take to be a poet? I think it takes a kind of will to degradation and a kind of perversity of the spirit.
All that. Plus, we might play a bit of Portuguese music, too, right here in Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. And good evening from Studio One. A bit of late breaking news. It is not 1400 in Quebec, if you're listening. On the Canadian East Coast, it's 1300 there. But with more news, we have James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Protesters in Afghanistan and Indonesia have been burning US flags and chanting Death to America slogans in renewed demonstrations over a film mocking the Prophet Muhammad. The film has unleashed a wave of anti-Western sentiment in the Muslim and Arab world. Indonesian police fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse hundreds of demonstrators who massed outside the US embassy in Jakarta. In Kabul, thousands of protesters took to the streets, setting fire to cars and shops and throwing stones at police. The demonstrations were the latest across the world, provoked by the short film made with private funds in the United States that depicted the Prophet Muhammad as a fool and womanizer. United Nations human rights investigators said they've drawn up a new secret list of Syrians and units suspected of committing war crimes who should face criminal prosecution. The independent investigators said they'd gathered an extraordinary body of evidence and urged the UN Security Council to refer the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court. However, Syrian National Council member Omar Shawaf says war crimes committed by the Assad regime are not equal to the mistakes Syrian rebels have made.
Unfortunately, the reports express some of the facts of the situation on the ground inside Syria. But in the same time, there is some mistakes in this report. I think this report was not equal enough. There is some mistake did by the opposition and armored opposition groups, but to show it, it's like an equal to what the regime did and what the Bashar Assad did, it's not fair.
Iran has accused the UN nuclear watchdog of a cynical approach and mismanagement and suggested terrorists and saboteurs might have infiltrated it. However, the comments have not deterred IAEA Director General Yukiya Amano, who said that the stalled talks between Iran and the IAEA would continue until a solution was found.
We will continue negotiations with Iran on a structured approach to resolving all outstanding issues. I hope we can reach agreement without further delay, to be followed by immediate implementation.
The US Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, said that only countries that play by the rules should be allowed access to nuclear technology.
The NPT recognizes this need for nuclear technology, and the United States will continue to collaborate with our international partners to ensure that countries play by the rules will have access to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
Greek judges, magistrates and judicial employees walked out of courts today at the start of a five-day strike to protest against a 12 billion euro austerity cuts package that could see substantial cuts to their salaries. The protesting judges held a meeting at the Athens Court of Appeal after beginning their strike, which will last for the rest of the working week. Art Deco masterpieces by French artists have gone on display at Christie's Art Gallery in Paris before they go under the hammer in New York at the end of the year. Expected to fetch up to $15 million, the 210-piece Steven Greenberg collection features designs from the 20th century and focuses on some of the most distinguished names in Art Deco, Jean Dunant, Jean Dupin and Jacques-Émile Roumand. The collection also includes Irish artist Eileen Gray's lacquered wood pieces. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. It's just 20.05, almost coming up to 20.06 in Tokyo. 2.06 in Tokyo, 20.06 in Tel Aviv, and 13.06 if you are listening in Boston. This is Midori House. We're back in a moment.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres,
Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Zurich, London.
Londres. Isto é Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monocle, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has just touched down in Beijing following a two-day visit to Tokyo. It's his third trip to the Asia-Pacific region in 11 months, reflecting a growing desire for stronger military presence in the region. And while the trip was not intended for tackling the increasing tensions emerging between China and Japan over the dispute at Senkaku Islands, it's been hard for him to ignore the elephant in the room.
It is in everybody's interest for Japan and China to maintain good relations and to find a way to avoid further escalation.
So how much is this likely to dominate his visit, and what other issues will he be tackling as he makes his way around the region? Well, joining me on the line now is Zainia Dormandy, Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy at London's Chatham House. Good evening.
Good evening.
Now, do you think that this particular trip, and I'm sure, well, maybe you do have access, I'm not sure, to his diary, do you think this actually jumped up by a couple of weeks or even a few days, just in terms of what we've been seeing over the last, really, 2 weeks, between what's happening between Taiwan and Japan on those islands?
So the answer is it's extremely unlikely that this was moved. I mean, if you were to take a look at the Defense Secretary Panetta's diary, these trips are scheduled months in advance. They're not easily flexed. This is, in large part, the whole trip comes from an invite that was made by the Chinese defense minister when he visited the United States earlier this year. This is very much in response. This is, as you stated earlier, this is in part to perhaps put oil on troubled waters. But this is also very much about America putting some meat behind the bones of the rebalancing to Asia, working with the Japanese, and also for the first time in, I think, something like 30 years of having a defense minister visit New Zealand, which has long been an ally and one that has suffered quite a lot in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
So if the trip was, of course, clearly locked in, how much of a rejuggling, though, has there been in terms of the actual talking points and agenda? And when we're looking at even just the images that we saw this morning of active live missile firing by Chinese vessels off the Senkakus, where does this discussion fit in the mix now?
So I think there's little question that the issue of the Senkakus and the conflict between Japan and China is going to have risen to the top or close to the top of the talking points. You know, from America's perspective, while it is said extremely clearly, and I think Secretary of State Clinton did on her trip to Asia just a couple of weeks ago, this is not America's fight. America is staying out of this, of any actually territorial dispute in the region. At the same time, clearly, if tensions rise to a certain level and red lines are crossed by one or the other side, given America's partnerships in the region, there's a great fear that America will be pulled in. That isn't in anybody's interest. It isn't in the Chinese interest. It isn't in the Japanese, in this particular case, interest, nor is it in the United States' interest. And so while America has said clearly, this isn't our fight, you guys need to sort this out peacefully between you, America does have enough interest to say, if we can help smooth the waters, we will also do that. And so there's no question that while from America, from Panetta's trip to China being focused in large part on building the military-to-military engagement and military-to-military understanding will be very, very high. So too will be engaging on these issues and trying to lower tensions.
Mm. As we've seen, whether it's been with the North Koreans, we've seen firefights that have occurred between the Japanese Coast Guard and North Korean ships in the past. There's certainly been, obviously, the very high profile of arrest of that Chinese trawler captain last year. I mean, it is very easy on the open waters, despite all that space, for vessels to collide, for things to go wrong. Aside from the U.S. and Panetta's tour, who else can be a calming voice of reason? Or is this just because it is China? And, of course, Japan being such a large ally of the United States, is it really ultimately come down to America having to mediate this?
I think ultimately it comes down to the powers themselves. In the end, America can only do so much. And you've seen, as I said earlier, the Secretary of State Clinton was out there earlier. Deputy Secretary of Defense Ash Carter was out there earlier over the summer. So America does have influence. America has influence in large part because of its partnerships in the region and because of the role it's seen in balancing isn't quite the right word, but it and China and that relationship and the strength and weakness of that relationship. But the real power to resolve these is in the countries concerned. So whether it's China and Japan or the Philippines or Vietnam, it is really these countries' ability to calm tensions, to step back from the brink, as it were. And the trouble is that you're seeing over the coming months a number of elections in the region, in South Korea and in Japan, that raise nationalist tensions. You've seen in China and in Japan, but particularly in China, the government allow, as it were, demonstrations take place against Japan. In cases, violent demonstrations against Japan, you've seen the governments allow a rise in nationalistic feeling, and that isn't productive.
No, and one only had to look at the images today of, I think we all are very aware that when the Chinese riot police, when they want to crack down, they can do that rather effectively. But I think we saw in front of not just the embassy, but Japanese department stores and automotive dealerships all over China over the past few days that they were largely letting people pretty much do just that and run riots. So I'm wondering, are we looking at this as just a little bit of, the government in China allowing people to let off national esteem, as we, move towards, a leadership conference in China? And does this start to go away once we see, new leaders and things calm down in Beijing a little bit?
I don't want to underplay the conflict and the tensions that you're seeing today, but you have to remember, this is not new. I mean, this is a recurring theme. A year ago and 2 years ago, you saw it, whether it was over China and the Philippines or China and Vietnam or China and Japan, which, one comes back to that regularly, the tension between China and Japan. As you noted, the arrest of the Chinese trawler captain was a case in point. So this is not new, and yet both countries, in the end, I think, recognize the importance of maintaining functional relationships at worst, if not positive ones at best. Both of them are trying to support economic growth, support their middle class, grow and develop their societies. In Japan's case, it's very much a question of how do we deal with the economic downturn that they've seen with the tsunami earlier this year, which has also hit them with their steadily aging population. They all have domestic problems for which a conflict with one another would not be helpful. And so I think that there is interest on both sides in the end to keep this manageable. But as you rightly say, to some extent, letting off a bit of steam, particularly given the leadership transitions in both countries, that can be seen as positive.
Indeed, and I would imagine that they must all keep an eye on the prize of, if we're to believe the numbers, say something like $500 billion dollars worth of trade every year just between China and Japan alone, if you ratchet it up. Xenia Dormady from Chatham House, thanks very much for that. You are listening to Midori House here in London. It is just 14 past the hour. We're back in a moment.
Monocle Film stepped into the kitchen to watch Chef Jonathan Conroy prepare the perfect summer meal. A traditional Turkish starter, spaghetti vongole from the Med, and a quintessential British classic, the raspberry trifle, deliciously take shape on screen.
the fresh coriander is a really important thing. You have to be heavy-handed on that, over-generous on the coriander. It's meant to, every flavour should pack a punch.
Summer on a Plate, on film, on Monocle.com.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block. Music on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, just 16 past 1800 here in London. Well, despite the economic turmoil and uncertainty continuing to engulf much of Europe, Sweden has appeared to remain immune. But there have been some signs to worry the money man in Stockholm of late, with growth forecasts revised down last week. On Thursday, Sweden will publish a budget designed to stimulate their economy, featuring a big cut to corporate tax rates and plans to boost spending on transport infrastructure and youth employment. So, is this good economics designed to deliver a shot in the arm of the potentially flagging economy? Or is it potentially a cynical voting ploy? Well, to assess the plans, we're joined on the line now by Ola Zachrisson. He is the business editor at Svenska Dagbladet in Stockholm. Hello, Ola.
Hi.
I wanted to start, maybe just frame this from, certainly from the perspective of a big Swedish daily like yours. How has this been playing out? Obviously, we've been seeing it on our screens and on wires through international services. But from a domestic point of view, how has it played on the newsroom floor of Svenska Dagbladet today?
I would say that the interpretation that most Swedes and most papers adhere to is that this is political tactics. It's actually not that the government is so stressed about the growth rate, but they are getting very stressed about the polls, that the opposition party, the big Social Democratic Party, is in a very firm lead now. And this government that has been accused of being very passive, now they want to show that they have muscles and that they can do stuff to stimulate the economy. And we have an election in 2 years' time, and that's why we see this quite more stimulant budget.
And do you think this is as much a domestic story, Ola, as it is a pan-European, even international one? Because, of course, if we look elsewhere in Europe, the narrative is austerity and it is, it just cuts. But here, we're talking about, stimulus and, we're hearing it might hit transport, it might hit other pockets of the economy as well. So domestic or also international?
Yeah, that Sweden has been quite firmly criticized also by, for example, the IMF, that we don't stimulate the economy enough. And at the moment, Sweden has become kind of a safe haven for investors. Our rates are very, very low. You can compare it to the very low rates of Germany. And then a lot of people think that the government should actually borrow more money at these very favorable rates and stimulate the economy, and that could be not only good for Sweden but good for the whole of the European economy, because as you said, it's a lot of talk about austerity measures now, and then you need some countries in the EU that actually can spend a bit of money as well. So I think you should look at it in that perspective, a broader international perspective.
Because one would imagine corporate tax rates, when that goes out as a message, obviously there's a domestic play, but I could imagine at a time when everyone is looking for inward investment, that one would hope that maybe some more multinationals will be setting up headquarters somewhere between Stockholm and Arlanda as well.
Yeah, Sweden is trying to pitch itself as a very as a very business-friendly country now. And there's actually a race between the two main political groups. We have this kind of liberal, right-leaning government at the moment, and the Social Democrats. And all the politicians are united in the view that we should make Sweden more business-friendly. So I think it's a very... they don't actually quarrel so much domestically about this, but everybody seems to have the same view, and that's also a bit worrying from a democratic perspective.
Is anyone talking, though, any parties about maybe room for cuts or certainly some type of fiscal reform that might look at that sacred cow being the welfare state? Certainly at a time right now when there's so much belt tightening going on, a lot of people look to Sweden, international companies as well, and say, great, that there's good education, and everyone speaks English, and this is all wonderful. But yet, there's sort of a cappuccino papa and mama society that everyone's off work for a year as well. And I'm wondering, from a competition point of view, is that being looked at?
That is not mentioned at all. None of the big political parties would actually dare to mention something like that, even if we have quite a few economists that say that we have to reform the labor market and these kind of labor market laws that we have. For example, that's a big structural thing that a lot of economists want to see. None of the political blocks would even dare to speak of those things, because this is such a solid, homogeneous country when it comes to defending the welfare state. So that is completely off the political agenda.
It's off the table. Tell me, what can we expect, though? I mean, aside from corporate tax cuts, potentially, there's talk about transport. What does this come in the form of? Building more four-lane highways? Is it more rail infrastructure? Where do you think we might see stimulus in that area?
Because now this government has two budgets to put forward before we go to an election in 2014. So in this budget, they focus on infrastructure. They focus on, for example, as you mentioned, the corporate tax rate. And everybody is expecting in the next budget that they're going to make more reforms that are actually aimed at the households and maybe also old age pensioners, for example. Reforms that really has an effect in your pocketbook. But in this budget, it's more like the infrastructure, the kind of big things in society. And the next one is gonna earn people a couple of kroners in the pocketbook.
Excellent. Ola Zachrisson, business editor at Svenska Dagbladet in Stockholm. Thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. Off for a break. Back with the London Design Festival in a moment.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle 24.
Välkommen till Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπρούσελ, Monocle Yermidart.
Λοντόστε Κασίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London Ball, as a Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπρούσελ, Monocle Yermidart.
London ist, sino Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que ninateiro no ar? Monocle 24.
Afto é no Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En a Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
And you're back with Midori House, 24 minutes past the hour here in London. Well, the London Annual Design Festival kicked off last Friday. Now in its 10th year, it's become one of the key dates on the global design calendar, with over 300 events and exhibitions happening across the city. Tomorrow sees a new event launching, the Global Design Forum. Its aim is to bring key global players in design together to set the agenda for the industry and explore and discuss issues affecting the sector. Well, joining me now in studio to tell us more is Max Fraser, Deputy Director of London Design Festival and organizer of the Global Design Forum. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, I want to ask, how is this almost collision that's occurred now between fashion as a lead-in and then also having, of course, the more industrial design side of things? How is that working over the last few years? Because they were sort of very distinct and separate before.
Yes, I mean, the Fashion Week has been around for a long time. We are in our 10th year of the design festival this year. And there's always been a clash of dates. There's not much we can do about that. There's a clash of pages on the Sunday supplements and so on. But I think the 10th year of the festival sees us really having grown so that the public understands what we do. We have a public programme. You know, we do interventions and installations within Trafalgar Square. A lot of stuff in the V&A and so on. So there's a real visibility across the city as well as all of our partner events. Mm.
So tell us about the form this year. Is the idea, is this more of a business-to-business play suddenly? Because obviously, as you said, so much of this exists in the public realm. Was there a need to perhaps focus things maybe a little bit more, bring in a new type of audience?
Yes. For some years now, the festival has been asked, why do you not have a thought leadership event? And quite right. So
who's asking that question?
Well, it's mainly the industry folks. So we, originally there was the World Creative Forum, which happened at the very beginning of the festival. And that was a very ambitious program and probably slightly ahead of its time. We needed to establish the festival first. And now after 10 years, we think we're in a position where we can put on a very comprehensive one-day program, which is the Global Design Forum, which takes place tomorrow, aimed very much at the industry.
And who's going to be speaking? And is there a common theme, thesis that you've given everyone? And I guess finally, what are you hoping people walk away with?
Well, we have about 7 sessions in the day, so it's a very packed program. And we have a real mix of speakers from around the world, because, of course, it's called the Global Design Forum. We have about 250 people attending from all over the world. And we've given ourselves a strapline of one day to set the global agenda for design. We're under no illusions that we can achieve that, but we'd like to make a headway on that. And the idea is that rather than it being a passive event whereby people sit there and be talked at, we're giving the delegates an opportunity to feedback their thoughts and ideas, so that at the end of it, we come together with a kind of mini manifesto, if you like, as to what the industry should be doing next. Mm. The idea of going forward is that to then do global design summits as a sort of mini events around the world throughout the year that feed into the Global Design Forum every September during the London Design Festival.
And will that still be facilitated by your body, or then are you working with other design organizations on a national level to make sure they happen? Or is part of the halo, I guess, of this that also London drives the agenda as well?
Certainly, certainly. But in order to have a global conversation, we have to lock into other major cities in the world, and we recognise that. So, we are hopefully doing one in Hong Kong in November. We'd like to do one in Brazil and so on. And we will be working with local players, of course, to make that happen. Mm.
As you said, you don't want people, talking at an audience. But from a thought leadership point of view, who will we be seeing? At least maybe speaking a little louder than others tomorrow?
Well, we've got a real mix. So we've gone for some very entrepreneurial characters. We've got some big heavyweight designers such as Tom Dixon, Richard Seymour, Thomas Heatherwick, Zaha Hadid, very familiar kind of headline names. Of course, we need some people from business. So we've got someone from the UK Trade and Investment, Christine Luskat, Alberto Alessi. We have Astro Teller. Dr. Astro Teller, I can see the smirk on your face with that. A fabulous name. He's the director of new projects at Google, and he'll be beaming in live from California through Google Plus. And we have a number of thinkers as well, like John Thackeray, Charles Leadbeater, Ben Terrett. We've got some people in the banking sector, Ellen Kiss from Brazil, Sarah Wise from Coutts,
It's a generous enough list.
Yes. Oh, and I got a call today. Would I like a McLaren delivered? Because we have the design director of McLaren joining us as well.
Of course, you've said no. You couldn't possibly take any corporate treats. But from, I want to go back to this idea of let's say, agenda setting and perhaps, charting a course across the horizon. Does a lot of this then go back to what happens to happen from an education point of view, stimulus in industry? Are there certain channels that you're hoping to drive the conversation towards in terms of coming to resolution?
Yes. I mean, we've been very mindful that there are a huge amount of channels that can be talked about in a day, and we've tried to make it pretty headline. So we've got a global session, we've got a digital session, we have a business session, an innovation and thinking session. And we're hoping that all of them will feed, with headline conversations, will feed into, percolate, if you like, into a mini agendas that can feed into future events.
And off the back of it, of course, it's only a one-day event, but does it become a manifesto online, in print? Is there a video diary of what's going to happen for those people listening? How can people access what happens tomorrow?
Yes, we are filming the event, so we will edit and turn around some of the key content very quickly. That'll be accessed on the globaldesignforum.com website. And the mini manifesto will be an online affair, which will be first sent to our delegates and then out into the wider spectrum.
Excellent. Max Fraser, Deputy Director of the London Design Festival. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. We are going to the headlines just after this break. Thank you.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24. Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres. Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monaco, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
This is Monaco 24.
And in the next half hour here on Midori House, we're going to crack the cover of the latest issue of our magazine. We'll also ask you how the map of a city might smell, or we'll have someone who's going to be mapping the smell of the city or something like that. Maybe our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, can help me with that one as well. We're also going to hear from the Indian author who recently made the shortlist for the UK's coveted Booker Prize.
What does it take to be a poet? I think it takes a kind of will to degradation and a kind of perversity of the spirit.
But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
Protesters in Afghanistan and Indonesia have been burning US flags and chanting Death to America slogans in renewed demonstrations over a film mocking the Prophet Muhammad. The film has unleashed a wave of anti-Western sentiment in the Muslim and Arab world. United Nations human rights investigators said they've drawn up a new secret list of Syrians and units suspected of committing war crimes who should face criminal prosecution. Iran has accused the UN nuclear watchdog of a cynical approach and mismanagement and suggested terrorists and saboteurs might have infiltrated it. However, the comments have not deterred IAEA Director General Yukiya Amano, who had said that stalled talks between Iran and the IAEA would continue. Greek judges, magistrates and judicial employees walked out of courts today at the start of a five-day strike to protest against a €12 billion austerity cuts package. The protesting judges held a meeting at the Athens Court of Appeal after beginning their strike, which will last for the rest of the working week. Art Deco masterpieces by French artists have gone on display at Christie's Art Gallery in Paris before they go under the hammer in New York at the end of the year. Expected to fetch up to $15 million, the 210-piece Steven Greenberg collection features designs from the 20th century. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. You are listening to Midori House, indeed, here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Berlay. And we're coming to you live from London. We're coming to you live from Studio One. And the new issue of the magazine, I think it's dropping through letterboxes all over the world. Hopefully those also in the Lusophone world, for those not familiar with that term, that refers to the Portuguese-speaking confederation around the world. And here to tell us a little bit more about that for our issue, which is quite fully themed on that topic, is our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
And hello.
Hello. And you already have the issue cracked open to, which is actually, that seems to be the Lusophone National sort of roundup, isn't it?
Yes, I have. I've started with our Lusophone top trumps.
I'm sure lots of people are trying to. I mean, everyone can hopefully get past Portugal and Brazil, but then, you know, people might get stumped after that. So
they might. Shall I do a little
who's
roundup?
In the club?
Okay, so Portugal and Brazil, we know them. Those are obvious. There's five more in Africa. Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde, and the ones that everyone always forgets, Sao Tome and Principe.
Yeah.
And there's one more on top of that as well, an eighth, and that's Timor-Leste, formerly known as East Timor, which is only became the eighth member about 10, 12 years ago when they became independent.
And is there also a looser confederation around that? Because we even have an occasional contributor on this program from Macau, who speaks with a rather thick Portuguese accent. So beyond that, are there also affiliate members too?
Yes. And what's interesting actually is the number of countries that want to become associate members or observer members of the Community for Portuguese Speaking Countries, the CPLP as it's known, includes some rather odd countries that you wouldn't expect, like, for example, Ukraine. Because Ukraine, when it was part of the old Soviet Union, invited students from countries that were in the Soviet bloc to come to the USSR to train. So, for example, the guy who actually, until a couple of weeks ago, headed up the CPLP, Domingos Simoes Pereira, who's a former government minister from Guinea-Bissau, he lived in Kiev for 6 years. He trained there. Mm. So even countries like Ukraine want to have some connection with the Lusophone world.
Now, I have to ask the question, do you think that people in Kiev really want, of course, people flooding in from Angola or Mozambique, or do you think it's more that they want to have nice relations so they can have bigger embassies and they can have a lot more bureaucrats in the sun?
Possibly, yes. But I'm sure they wouldn't mind having a little bit of Angolan money pouring into Kiev.
Well, absolutely.
If not, if they weren't head over heels about Angolans themselves coming. But it's interesting that this group, the CPLP, it's tiny. They've got 20 staff members. They've got a budget of about 2 million euros.
So you went down to Lisbon, to their HQ, which they have a rather handsome villa, maybe a little bit frayed at the edges.
It's an old palace, the Palacio Conde de Penafiel, which used to belong to a count in the 18th century. And they moved in there earlier this year, in February this year, and have sort of done a bit of a refit to it. Mm. It's a little bit echoey. Mm. It's quite big.
More soft furnishings, maybe.
Yes, and there's not quite enough of them. But they've got some very grand ambitions. For example, all loose...
Grand crazy or...?
Grand sort of crazy, but you never know.
Right.
So... they'd love to have a Schengen-style visa waiver agreement. So if you're Brazilian, you could just move to Cape Verde and that's fine. Mm. I'm not entirely sure if that's going to happen, but it's a nice idea. They even want the idea that if you've got a university degree in Mozambique, then that would be respected in Portugal. And they have a lot of things in common, aside from the language. They all have coastlines. I mean, it's a bit of an oxymoron to call an explorer lazy, but it is notable that Portuguese explorers got to the coast and then thought,
we're not going to track much further.
Yeah. So all of them have got coasts.
Did you identify, though, the idea of having to have a passport-free or at least sort of visa-free world, with Portuguese being the defining element of it? Did you get a sense that there are actually working groups, aside from just sort of talk and having grand ambitions, but, proper working groups, working in all capitals to make these things happen?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, I think what's interesting is that, I mean, when I first looked into this, I thought, what do these countries have in common? What does, Timor-Leste have in common with Brazil? And then you realise that as soon as you have language as a common theme, suddenly everything else goes because, if you're in Portugal and you can't get a job, you'll move to Mozambique or you'll move to Brazil. So people would move like that. When Timor-Leste became a country, they needed some judges. The UNDP, UN Diplomatic Program, was in charge of East Timor and thought, well, we need to get some judges from somewhere that speak Portuguese. So they got 15 from Cape Verde to go over. Mm. So suddenly you get these links that wouldn't have come if they didn't speak the same language.
And do you have, or did you get any sense when you were there, though, that... the Commonwealth, Pan-American nations, that they also take this quite seriously, and they see that this could actually become a bit of a serious political bloc, or certainly, when you reference, the great rush we're seeing to Mozambique, already established Angola, the power of Brazil, that this is an economic bloc to be reckoned with.
No, I don't think anyone takes it seriously as a group yet. I think they could. I mean, individually, they take Brazil seriously, and that people are beginning to take Angola seriously because of its quite enormous oil wealth. But there's no. I mean, the CPLP would love to be seen as a powerful bloc, and there's certainly some very ambitious people within it who believe it's got real potential. But at the moment, no, it's not. It's not a powerhouse. Mm.
And any internal struggle, because one would almost argue that perhaps such an organization, maybe Lisbon's a little bit past its sell-by date, and perhaps it should be led out of Brasilia.
Well, exactly. There is this sort of odd sense that this is an organisation that's been established in a former colonial master that's doesn't really have much, doesn't even have delusions of grandeur anymore, let alone its own grandeur. But no one wants to take it off them yet. But there's certainly Angola's becoming very influential, which means that they don't really talk about democracy and human rights as much as you get the impression the staff would like to talk about. So it's certainly interesting. And when we spoke to Antonio Patriota, the Brazilian foreign minister, who I also sat down with when he was in London for this issue as well. Yeah, he was talking about, you know, the importance of the Lusophone world and those links, and he hopes that they'll become a little stronger over the coming years.
Steve Bloomfield, do you want to set up a song or should I set
up
a song?
Yes, no, I'm happy to set this up. So we're going to be playing a little bit of Lusophone music throughout Midori House this week. Mm-hmm. None of these tracks, I must say, come from the Brazilian foreign minister. Now, the reason I mention that is because he would not stop talking about music when I was interviewing him. But his music is more, you know, Chicago blues guitarist rather than this. So this is not from him, but I'm sure he'd like it. It's Nossa Nossa. It's made famous, would you know, by Michel Teló.
Nossa, nossa, assim você me mata. Ai, se eu te pego, ai, ai, se eu te pego. Delícia, delícia, ai, ai, se eu te pego, hein? Eu quero ver só você, já. Nossa, nossa.
And that was I See Chipego, or more commonly known as Nossa Nossa by Michel Teló here on Midori House on Monocle 24. When we come back, we are going to be hearing from Indian author Jitail here on the programme.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
And welcome back to Midori House. It's 22:43 if you're listening in Tashkent. It's 18:43 here in London. Well, the coveted Man Booker shortlist was announced last week, and one of the names on the list is first-time novelist Jitail from India. His book called Narcopolis, it's a look at the history of Bombay through a haze of opium smoke. It's somewhat autobiographical for Tail, who spent two decades in the grip of heroin and opium addiction. He's now clean and making up for lost time in true Renaissance man style. Before gaining attention as a novelist, he was already a well-known poet. He's also written an opera called Babur in London, which earlier this year played in both Zurich and London. And his most recent project is a musical one, a duo called Sridhar Tail, in which he plays guitar and sings. Our New Delhi correspondent, Arti Vetigeri, caught up with him recently to find out more.
Here's what I got a lung full of junk, got a fist full of...
It's a secret history of Bombay, opiated history of Bombay over about 30 years with an interlude in China. And the time span in the book is about 50 years. And it's a kind of history of opiates, because it's a little known fact about Bombay that it turned from a collection of 7 malarial islands into the financial capital of India in the first 40 years of the 19th century, when a group of Parsi ship owners got together with the East India Company and exported opium to China. And that really changed the fortunes of Bombay. It was opium that made Bombay the metropolis we know today. And this is a part of its history that most history books omit. And I thought, if you're writing a book about the opium dens of Bombay, there's just no way you can avoid telling that part of the story as well. And although my novel doesn't talk about the actual historical changes that Bombay went through, it's underlying the entire narrative.
There's some really quite vivid imagery in the book. I mean, I've read passages where I can see the green curls of smoke and I can smell the smells of 70s era Bombay. Was it hard to kind of conjure that up?
In fact, I'm reluctant to say how easy it was, because although it's been 10 years since I left that world and have been clean and sober, I was in it for more than 20 years, and you know, that's a long stretch of time, and I think you internalize things and you become a person that you kind of forget about until you start to write about it, and then you remember everything. And I remember things I had no idea I knew, you know, memories and faces and smells, and I was astonished at how easy it was. And it was so easy, I worry about myself.
So you were quite intent during your years in Bombay, you were quite intent on really discovering the city from its source point.
Yeah, from its source points, and probably its most disreputable source points. I came here in 1979 to do a BA from Hong Kong, and within a month or so went to an opium den, which just happened to be 5 minutes away from my college. It was very, very seductive. Yeah, and I think it's a fallacy. It's a kind of a great romantic myth that drugs help writing. Because when you're doing drugs, the only thing you can do is drugs. It's a full-time job. And to fund that full-time job, I had another full-time job, which was journalism. And between those two full-time jobs, honestly, there was nothing left over to write a word, which is why my debut novel came out at the age of 52. You know.
Now, how does one become a poet? Is one a poet even if they're not making a living or writing at that moment?
Very interesting you should say that. I've had long discussions about this with friends, and I think you can only call yourself a poet when you're writing a poem. You know, because, you know, otherwise you're just another civilian. What does it take to be a poet? I think it takes a kind of will to degradation and a kind of perversity of the spirit. You work very hard at it. It's not until you're about 40 or so that you figure out what you're doing in terms of poetry, in terms of your craft and in terms of form and all those things. And it takes ages for any kind of recognition to come your way. It takes ages for any kind of money to come your way. And if fame ever arrives, it arrives at a time when you're no longer interested in it.
So what keeps you going then?
I think hunger. I hate to use the word spiritual, but I think I might have to. You know, this is not something that's unique to poets. It's true with carpenters as well, with anybody who works with their hands. You know, it's wanting to do as good a job as you can and to learn how to do it very, very well. And especially with something like writing, I think it's only after you do it for a long time that you realize what it entails and what it requires and whether you're any good at it. And once you figure that out, you can't. There's no way you're going to be able to leave it.
And now I'd love to talk more about the opera. Sure. So it's Barbird in London. So is it set in the modern day, and how experimental an idea is it?
It is set in modern day London. I think it's so experimental an idea, it's almost insane. And at this point, you know, it started several years ago when Edward Rushton, the composer, and I got together and we talked about this idea. And then the opera group in London got interested and it took off. And now when I saw it open in Zurich, it was no longer this very delicate kind of very fragile idea that we'd been talking about. And Edward writes this absolutely amazing kind of difficult music, and there's this poetry and this insane story.
So essentially Barber was a marauding, rapacious Mughal warrior / emperor who is telling some would-be young terrorists to strike or not to strike?
No, interestingly not to. He's also telling them that they are not well-versed enough in the Quran, that they don't think about God, that they don't know anything about poetry. Because the interesting thing about Babur, why he's such a compelling character, a magnetic character, is because, yes, he was bloodthirsty. He was the first jihad. I mean, he thought about kind of institutionalizing terror in such a way that he invaded and conquered India very easily, and he was the first to do that. He was also an amazing poet, and the Babarnama, the book he wrote, is full of beautiful poetry, amazing poetry, and full of amazing literary criticism. So for me, the fascination of this character is, on the one hand, an amazing poet with a great feeling for the arts, for painting, for music. He's constantly talking about singers and about painters, and he loves it. You can tell that he loves the arts on the one hand, and on the other, this absolutely ruthless, cold-blooded killer is what he was, you know. And somehow, when you read the Babarnama and you think about Babur, there is really no disconnection between those two things. They are not disparate, but part of one very full and rich character.
And that was Booker-nominated writer Jeet Tail speaking to our Arti Bettigeri in India. Babur in London has already played in Zurich and London, and in November will hit five cities across India. And you're listening to Midori House. It is just 1852 here in London. Well, Stockholm, London, Cape Town, many of us know what these cities look like on a map, but how about their smell? Well, Berlin-based Norwegian artist Sissel Tollas has been working to explore just this. Originally from a scientific background, her work is focused on relationships between smell and communication. Alongside her art projects in different cities, she has worked for companies and organizations including Sony, the BBC, KPMG, Mercedes-Benz, and Harvard University. Her latest project, which opened recently, focuses on Kansas City, inviting the public to explore the smells of their city. And she joins us on the line now from Berlin. Hello, Sissel.
Hello, good evening, London.
Good evening, Berlin. Tell us just the idea of mapping the city, you know, through one's nose. How did the idea come about?
Kansas City is one of several cities I put my nose into. How does the city come across from the perspective of a dog's position, more or less, if I may say it like that? And Kansas City is the latest in this road of cities, and it is a different one, a different approach, and a different outcome. 5 years of research is now on display in Kansas City, Missouri, in other words, in two different states and two different cities. And it is in form of a play, a game, which you can download to your smartphone. And you run around the city and you find replicated smell cards, which I have replicated from smells from those respective neighborhoods. I'm sorry, a little bit jet-lagged here still. And yes, so you collect the cards and then you contribute with words and terms around the smells that you find. You download all this to the app, and we gain all this information into the central smell station, which is Institute Grand Arts. And I have been working with this project for so many years, and it's amazing to see it out there and in form of a game, which is so beyond what I suspected at all. People having joy discovered in the neighborhoods from the perspective of this. Of the nose, and it's fantastic.
Tell us, because as you said, the smells are, you have to go and find these synthetic scent cards all over the place. I mean, it sounds, on one side, it sounds, you know, potentially like not a terribly expensive project because people can build apps. But then when you get into synthetic smells, etc., that's a rather costly venture. I mean, is there huge partners? I mean, did you have to work with the likes of Givaudan or Firmenich or any of these big scent firms? I mean, how did that side come about?
Since 2004, the IFF, ENC, International Flavors and Fragrance New York, have been big sponsors and supporters of my knowledge and my lab. And all projects I do involving the smell and the nose have been very immense supported by this company. And together with the knowledge of IFF, I have been developing certain technologies that enable us to do this kind of stuff, like putting those kind of smells on through the microencapsulation, the nanotechnology microencapsulation, which had its origin in scratch and sniff technology, but this has been taken much further, and it's amazing. You just touch the surface of the card, it's like touching the surface of the skin of the city. And what is essential in this project is there is no hierarchy. There are all kinds of smells, pretty smells that are pretty devastating and others that are pretty normal. And this is what also makes the quality of the project across two states, across borders, across the issue of segregation, which is a big issue in the Midwest, and also across the fact that that part of the world, most people go by car. And here they ask to walk and smell, put their nose one level more, even more down than normally would do. So it's a many levels here, and people having so much fun. You should have seen them the 2 days after the launch of the app and the project. There's like all the school classes out there, you know, field working and activating their amazing noses. And yeah, it's fantastic.
Sissel, just before we go, if you had to rank them, and of course now you have some distance between you and Kansas City, what are the three standout smells for you, if you had to just name three?
Oh, a very interesting smell that kind of dominates the two states, because I'm working here in two states, Missouri and Kansas, and two cities, Kansas City, Missouri, is the sewage. The sewage is placed on the border, somehow in the outskirts of one city and the beginning of the other. And this became the kind of the core of my project. And there have been done many attempts to cover up this smell, among others with the smell of a cupcake and others. And having the possibility to investigate into a lot of different smells, I discover many, many interesting smell combinations, and especially around the issue of sewage.
Sissel, we're going to have to, I don't want to leave it on a smelly note like sewage, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Sissel Tolas in Berlin. That's all the time we have for today. The program was produced by Katie Bilbo. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond here in London. The Culture Show is going to be here next, and that's with Robert Bounden in 3 hours' time at 2200 London time. Ted Kravitz and Tamsin Smith will be back with the Monocle Daily, and our lovely Steve Bloomfield is going to be in this seat tomorrow. But for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye. Have a good evening.